Welcome to Done and Done. I'm Alicia, your hostess on this podcast journey, exploring and connecting the world, the universe of Dominic Dunn. We are back for the conclusion of Bad Blood, the real feud between Truman Capote and Gore Vidal featuring Lee Radziwill. We have defined the relationship between Truman and Gore. We have talked about what Truman has to say about the whole thing. In this episode, we are going to explore a bunch of other primary sources. What happened at the White House from the people who were there? How did it get told? How did it get translated? And how is Truman utterly betrayed by his dear princess, Lee Radziwill? Oh, it's mean. It's super petty, y'all. I think you're gonna love it. Let's investigate. Okay, friends, so Gore is suing Truman for libel. Again, suspicious timing on that. He's going in for the kill. Gore is, remember, Viper Man. There's a lot to unpack here. Let's go ahead and go to what the actual people who were actually there at the White House in 1961 said about whatever kerfuffle happened. This next bit is from George Plimpton, recalling the night at the White House in his book, Truman Capote, in which various friends, enemies, acquaintances, and detractors recall his turbulent career. Let's go to an eyewitness from George Plimpton. The whole episode goes back to a dinner dance at the White House in the Kennedy administration. If memory serves, it was at that occasion that Franklin Roosevelt Jr. rose from his table in the East Room to toast Stash Radziwill, Lee's husband at the time. The problem was that Stash at the moment of Roosevelt's toast was in a plane landing at what was then New York's Idlewild Airport. His flight had been delayed by storms. The man Roosevelt was toasting, the man Roosevelt thought was Stash Radziwill, was in fact Oleg Cassini, the dress designer. President Kennedy was highly amused, doubled over in his seat and trying not to let on so that Roosevelt would go on and on with his encomiums. In any case, the dancing went on after dinner, and it was then that I saw the confrontation between Gore and Bobby Kennedy. Gore was standing next to Jackie, and in a gesture that one might consider quite proper since they were old friends and related by marriage, he had his arm lightly around her waist at the small of her back. Bobby saw this and quite rudely removed Gore's arm, saying to the effect that that sort of thing doesn't go around here, whereupon there was a sharp exchange of words. My memory is that they involved the power of the word, Gore stressing that no one should treat a writer that way unless he expected retaliation in words, and Bobby, doubting Gore's ability to do any such thing with his pen, typewriter, whatever. Jackie told me many years later that the real reason for Gore's expulsion from the White House circle was that he had cornered Lem Billings, the former roommate of the president and practically a family member, and had verbally humiliated him in a hallway. Gore, whom I have known and admired since we were schoolmates years back, has since written me a letter in which he says that he never saw Lem Billings before or after that event, although he did know that he was Jack's fag friend from Choate. He went on to write, "As I was passing by, Lem asked, 'Why don't you come to the meetings of the Council on the Arts?' I replied demurely that I didn't think government should meddle in the arts. He, drunk or in a choleric seizure, denounced me, ending, 'Well, then why did you go on the council?' I said President Kennedy appointed me without asking. I graciously said nothing and never attended a meeting. End of story." Well, there we are. I should mention that the drinks served at those White House affairs, those private parties, were tankard size, and that because of nerves or whatever, everyone tended to over-imbibe. I remember Vice President Lyndon Johnson in a pale blue dinner jacket taking a header onto the dance floor, falling in a heap on top of a great beauty, and leaping off her like a jackrabbit and hauling her up, all this so quickly that it was hard to tell what happened unless you had your eye on them. At any rate, what happened was that Truman gave an interview to a rather second-rate skin magazine called Playgirl. It had a male playmate for the centerfold, in which Truman reported to the interviewer that Gore had been bodily thrown out of the White House. Lee Radziwill had told him about the incident, and in a sense it was true because Gore was never invited back, but it was the word bodily that initiated Vidal's lawsuit. I could never quite imagine how this could happen in the rather decorous setting of the White House. In fact, I wrote a parody in which the scene was described. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. had thrown Gore Vidal out of the White House onto Pennsylvania Avenue, which was the length of two football fields away from the front steps, a long toss for anyone, but which was logical enough if you knew what a great arm Schlesinger had and how he had gripped Vidal by the laces and spiraled him. But Gore didn't accept it that way. That's George Plimpton's point of view. What does Gore Vidal say happened at the White House? Again, from Plimpton's collection on Truman Capote, this is Gore Vidal. There were no witnesses to what happened. Nobody saw anything. I was squatting down beside Jackie in the north curve of the blue room. She was in an armless chaise, and I rose for support. I needed her near shoulder. I picked shoulder. As I did, Bobby came up behind her and took my hand off. She sees nothing. I then went over, and there are no witnesses to any of this either, and said to Bobby, "Don't ever do that again." "What do you mean, buddy boy? You're nobody." Something like that. I said, "Never say that. Writers have so many words, we usually have the last one." Not bad for my state of rage, which escalated quickly to, fuck you too. And that was the end of it. I recently showed Hillary Clinton the spot where it took place. Blue room door into the red room. Should there be a plaque? That's what Gore said happened. Others have some more to say. We're going to go ahead and take a peek into Darwin Porter's Pink Triangle for just a little bit more about the seedier way the story is told. Unpacking this just a little bit more. The September-October 1975 edition of Playgirl showcased a headline on its front cover. Outrageous interview with Truman Capote. Its subhead trumpeted, "Gore Vidal, Bobby threw him out of the White House." In the article, Truman claimed that this was the only time that Gore had ever been invited to the White House. According to Truman, he not only got drunk, but insulted Jackie's mother, Bobby Kennedy, and Arthur Schlesinger, I believe it was, and one of the guards, just picked Gore up and carried him to the door and threw him out onto Pennsylvania Avenue. That's when he began to write all those cruel pieces about the Kennedys. As his source for this information, Truman listed his close friend, Lee Radziwill. The fireworks were yet to come in a retaliatory blast from Gore at that ill-starred bash in Camelot. As best as the RFK versus Gore story can be pieced together, Jackie had invited Gore to the White House, mainly because of his status as the stepson of Hugh Auchincloss, who also had been the stepfather to both Lee and Jackie. After the party, Gore sustained an extended chat with Janet Auchincloss, mother of Jackie and Lee, although there is no evidence that Gore insulted the matriarch. Witnesses said that Gore made several visits to the well-stocked bar and became noticeably drunk before he had confrontations with both Lem Billings and Robert Kennedy. Gore had long been fascinated by the intimate relationship between JFK and Lem Billings. He was not only Jack's lifelong slave, but had been in love with him ever since he'd gone down on him in the shower back in 1933 at Choate. Jackie once told me she'd love to spend a weekend with her husband without Lem tagging along. Because of his bad back, Jack was even helped into his jockey shorts by Lem, who also put on his black socks in the morning. Gore later claimed that Lem had challenged me for not attending meetings of the Council on the Arts. I told him that I didn't believe the government should involve itself in the arts. In print, Gore referred to Lem as the principal fag at court, who wanted to eliminate any potentially controversial figure from the scene. In Lem's view, there was room for only one queer in residence at the White House. He always wanted to be near the only man he ever loved. Gore admitted that he and Lem had exchanged words, none of them pleasant. I detested the little creep. In fact, I ended our dialogue by telling him, "Why don't you go suck a cock? Not mine, the president's." The fag stormed away in a huff. Later, Gore was crouched next to Jackie, who was sitting in an armchair. As he rose to his feet, rather unsteadily at this point, he balanced himself by placing a hand on her shoulder. Bobby saw that and rushed over to Gore, asking him to remove his hand from the First Lady. As Bobby turned to leave, Gore shouted at him, "Don't ever do anything like that again. I've always thought you were an impertinent son of a bitch." "What do you mean, buddy boy?" RFK asked. "You're a nobody. Why don't you go fuck yourself?" "Fuck off yourself." The Attorney General not only walked away, disentangling himself from further confrontation, but asked Arthur Schlesinger and George Plimpton to drive Gore home because he was obviously too drunk to do it himself. In brief, Gore wasn't thrown onto Pennsylvania Avenue, but escorted and driven away from the White House grounds. Although many aspects of the incident were disputed, both sides agreed that RFK and Gore had engaged in a verbal fight. Within the pages of his memoir, Palimpsest, Gore got even with RFK. Between Bobby's primitive religion and his family's ardent struggle ever upward from the Irish bog, he was more than usually skewed, not least by his own homosexual impulses, which Rudolf Nureyev once told me were very much in the air on at least one occasion when they were together. "We did share a young soldier once," he said, "American soldier." Anyone who has 11 children must be trying to prove, disprove, something other than the ability to surpass his father as an incontinent breeder. Yikes. Okay, at his home in Rovella, along Italy's Amalfi Coast, Gore received a copy of the Playgirl interview and was angry and shocked at the inaccuracies. He decided not to sue, having been burned in his libel suit against right-winger William F. Buckley. "My experience with Buckley made me sensitive to the misuse of libel laws to discourage free speech. But in Amsterdam, when confronted with row upon row of copies of Playgirl displayed in a local kiosk, he decided to sue Truman for libel. Shortly thereafter, he filed a $1 million lawsuit." The press went wild. Not since Oscar Wilde threatened the Marquess of Queensbury with slander had such a lawsuit generated so much publicity. At the age of 53, Gore was suing Truman, aged 54. The press referred to them as a pair of razor-tongued salon fighters aboil with malice. Oh, it is just so dirty, dirty, dirty. Okay, there is an incident at the White House. There were verbal exchanges with Lem Billings, with Robert Kennedy, with Jackie, with Janet Auchincloss. Gore didn't exactly get thrown out. He was driven away, but Truman tells this story to Playgirl and Richard Zoe Rink, and of course, he doesn't think a thing about it. He's heard this story from Lee Radziwill, his dear princess. I can't imagine Truman thinks a thing about it. Gore wants to sue me. My best friend Lee will certainly have my back and say she's the one who told me the story and we can all be done with it. That is not what happens. Taking the next part of this particular story from Liz Smith, famed columnist and friend of Dominic Dunn's. When Truman got involved in this lawsuit with Gore Vidal, Truman said to me, "Gore really likes you. You're one of the only people in the world who he thinks is really fair-minded." "How do you know that?" "Well, I know because people have told me. Now, Liz, if you went to him." I said, "Look, I've already talked to him. I've tried, but he won't drop the suit." So then Truman mourns a little more, and he goes on that he's going to have to pay $1 million, and he says, "You know, this story about his being thrown out of the White House is true. this really happened? Well, I didn't know whether it was or not, but I'd been hearing it for years. Truman certainly wasn't the only person who ever told the story about Gore and Jackie Kennedy and how incensed Bobby Kennedy was with Gore. So then Truman said, "You know, Lee likes you, and if you go to her and ask her please to testify on my behalf that all this actually happened, then Gore wouldn't stand a chance." I said, "Well, she's your good friend." "Well, I asked her and she says no, but I feel if you ask her, she might do it." I said, "You have this unrealistic faith in my powers. I don't have any powers to influence these people." "Yes, please, please ask her for me. She won't even return my phone calls." I thought, some friendship. So I called Lee and I said, "Look, Truman is in really bad shape. He loves you so much and he really needs you to come forward in this situation and at least say if it did happen. Yes, this incident did happen and Mr. Capote didn't make this up. Otherwise, Gore is going to win this lawsuit and it's just going to crush Truman." She said to me, "Oh, Liz, what does it matter? They're just a couple of fags." I almost fainted. I just couldn't believe that she had said that. I don't know why I was surprised. Most people are intensely homophobic deep down, and these things spring out of them when they're not thinking. I called Truman back. I said to Truman, "She won't do it." "Well, what did you say? What did she say?" He went on and on. He was tormented. My common sense held me back from telling him what she had said. But finally, in the end, I did tell him, because he absolutely wouldn't take no for an answer. He had this uncanny thing of knowing when you were lying. So he started really pushing me around verbally, saying, "Oh, you're such a sissy. You're so soft-hearted. You're never going to get anywhere in life because you just can't tell the truth. And this is really important, and I need to know exactly what she said. Didn't she ask anything about me?" And blah, blah, blah. Finally, I became exasperated, I guess. I don't know. I shouldn't have done it. But I told him what she said. Well, he went totally berserk. He went on the Stanley Siegel show. The next thing Truman was telling on the air was this perfectly awful story about Bill Buckley and Lee. He dredged up the worst thing he knew about Lee. It has the ring of truth, but how do I know? He said that Lee had conceived this great passion for Bill Buckley. She wanted to have an affair with him. But he was so straight-laced and such a good Catholic that she devised a story that she was thinking of converting and she wanted him to give her advice and instruction. Well, I imagine Bill Buckley has been asked a lot of things. I have no idea how far it went or if it happened, and I'm sure he's too much of a gentleman to admit that it happened. I said to Truman later, "How could you have told that story? You always said that Lee was the greatest person in the world." "Well, I'll show her," he said. I said, "This is not good, and believe me, I don't want to be old-fashioned, but no man ever gets anywhere by cackling publicly. It won't go down to your credit." He said, "I guess you think I give a shit," and things like that. He went crazy, just disintegrated. The situation went from one bad thing to another. So in a funny way, he became the horrible toad that all of these people had felt he was for betraying their confidences. Y'all, Truman is mad. Truman is so mad. Not just at Gore, but now at dear Princess Lee Radziwill. She has turned on him. I want to take a deeper insight about how Truman Capote may be feeling in the very best lens. We're not going to end on the best lens, but let's show a little grace and dress the set, so to speak. This is from Judy Greene talking about this particular time. Judy Greene says, "When Truman talked to me about the people who had turned on him, it was with the greatest bitterness I'd ever heard. He would talk with tears in his eyes about the people he believed betrayed him. He felt that his strong suit was his loyalty. A terrific betrayal was Lee Radziwill. She was the worst of all because she wasn't in Lacote Basque. He had this relentless despair at what has happened to what he thought was one of his best friendships. He didn't feel he'd ever done anything to her. In fact, quite the opposite. He felt that he'd saved her life. What he did for Babe was to be her confidant, make her laugh. But with Lee, he was life-saving, life-giving. Whether it was Laura pulling her out of a depression, getting her over the Onassis debacle, or being Jackie's sister, he had a wellspring of Southern compassion that many call syrup, but with Truman, it was genuine. Now, if you're Lee Radziwill and Truman Capote's dog has eaten your new sable coat and arranged a movie, Laura, for you, a movie that didn't go over great at all, sold you for that movie with the "I have a friend whose life is so empty of accomplishment," Truman Capote has been, in Lee's point of view, drunk in her home, misusing alcohol and drugs with her young children. And Truman Capote is truly deep in addiction in the early 70s. Perhaps if you're Lee, I can understand how you might crave a little distance. But it is this "who cares, it's just a bunch of fags" remark that sends Truman Capote over the edge. It gets nasty, it gets ugly. And what did Truman Capote say? "I'll tell you something about fags, especially Southern fags. We is mean. A Southern fag is meaner than the meanest rattler. We just can't keep our mouth shut." Truman will not keep his mouth shut at all. We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, this is really where it's going to get fun. Truman is so mad, so mad, and is going to be meaner than the meanest rattler. See you on the flip. Oh, investigators, this is where it really, really, really gets to be delightful. So, 1975, September, Playgirl interview. October 75, Esquire release. Now, remember the worst thing Truman said about his dear princess, Lee Radziwill, was that she and Jackie were a pair of Western geishas. That's it. That's as deep as he got into Lee. He left her unscathed. Truman knows the story of what happened at the White House from Lee. There's no reason that she can't just say, "Yeah, that happened. I told Truman about it." Lee doesn't want to get involved. Her lawyer is Gore's lawyer, who advises Lee just to keep her mouth shut. And then she does the whole "who cares, just a bunch of fags" thing. Okay, this incenses Truman Capote. This is all shaking down in the summer of 1979. Here is where we enter into this story. Sally Quinn, reporting for the Washington Post in two parts about this whole affair in June of 1979. I want to connect a few spiderwebs. Stick with me. Sally Quinn at this time is married to Ben Bradley. They have married the year before. Ben Bradley, editor of the Washington Post. Remember, Ben Bradley's second wife was Antoinette Pinchot, sister of Mary Pinchot Myers, mistress of JFK. Episode 19 is when we told Mary Pinchot Myers' story here on Done and Done. Ben Bradley, hired by Katharine Graham in 1965. Katharine Graham, owner of the Washington Post, honoree for Truman's 1966 black and white ball. Another thing to know about Ben and Sally Quinn, in the same year, 1979, just 2 months after this piece is published, Ben and Sally will buy Gray Gardens, the beachside home of Edith Bouvier, big, and her daughter, Edith Bouvier, little. What? The Bradleys buy Gray Gardens in August of 1979. They'll begin their renovations in November. Holy cats, it really does all connect. I almost fainted when I saw Sally Quinn as the byline for this one. This is definitely a primary source. You're going to hear some information in this that has been used in other pieces within these episodes, but this two-part article is fire, fire. It is a whale of a story. Sally Quinn gets the scoop. Take several seats. Y'all are not ready for this. I know I was not. From Sally Quinn, part one, from the Washington Post, posted June the 6th, 1979. This article is called In Hot Blood. Subhead, betrayed. Truman Capote reviles the Principessa Radziwill. This whole thing is a literary Watergate, and Gore Vidal is Richard Nixon. The Princess Lee Radziwill is Deep Throat in more ways than one. It's a quote from Truman. That's how the article opens. Sally Quinn writes, Truman Capote is hurt. He is hurt because he has been betrayed. Betrayed by his best, closest, dearest, and most loyal friend of 20 years, Lee Radziwill. You see, Truman Capote and Gore Vidal, two of America's most illustrious writers, have been engaged in a fierce and vicious lawsuit for the past 4 years. Gore Vidal sued Truman for $1 million when Capote told Playgirl magazine that Vidal had been thrown out of the White House after behaving very badly one night at a party Jack and Jackie Kennedy gave for Lee and Stash Radziwill. Truman Capote contends that Lee Radziwill told him the story. He also says that Radziwill promised to sign a deposition for him saying so, but then she backed off. And then she signed a deposition for Gore Vidal, whom she reportedly detests and has recently called the most sinister man I know. But it gets worse. According to Capote, she then told a New York columnist who asked her to explain the about-face, well, you know what they are. They're just a couple of fags, and this is just a fight between two fags. I think it's disgusting that we have to be dragged into it. There she goes, using the royal we again, says Capote. Next, she'll start talking in the third person. The princess feels, the princess declines. It's the fag thing that really got to Capote. If the lovely, divine, and sensitive Princess Radziwill has such a low opinion of homosexuals, hisses Capote, then why did she have me for a confidant for the last 20 years? I would say, says Capote, that from 70% to 80% of Lee's friends and Jackie's friends are homosexual. He grins mischievously. When Nureyev hears that, I dare say he'll not be amused. As anyone can see, Capote, 54, has not been terribly happy about what he considers treachery in the first degree by his former best friend. And he is not a man to be trifled with. Several years ago, Capote created a scandal with the appearance in Esquire magazine of the first two segments of his work in progress, Answered Prayers. In it, he had gleaned from the lives of most of the rich and the beautiful people he had been living, playing, and gossiping with for years. Many of his closest friends, including Babe Paley, the late wife of CBS head William S. Paley, disowned him, so outraged were they by what they believed to be a betrayal of their confidences. But Capote had told when he knew, and he knew a lot. It was also difficult for his friends, or former friends, as many soon became, to try to deny much of what Capote wrote in Answered Prayers. His success with In Cold Blood, a journalistic novel about the murder of a Midwest family, had been crafted and pieced together, often from his extraordinary memory rather than explicit notes. At any rate, Capote had the wherewithal for effective and exacting retribution. He chose to take it on Princess Radziwill, 46. He called up the Stanley Siegel Show on WCBS in New York, a live talk show, and arranged to go on yesterday morning at 9 for 1 hour of revenge. Well, of course, he said beforehand, what I'm going to say isn't very gentlemanly, but she described me as a fag. Fags are supposed to be bitchy. So let's go. What Capote had in mind to yesterday was to trash his former confidant, to tell all the dirt she'd been laying on him for the last 20 years. I'm going to do the most devastating job, he warned. She's going to pay for it aujourd'hui. I don't even have to get warmed up. I'm pretty warm now. This morning, says Capote, I woke up remembering something Stash Radziwill had said to me after I helped Lee establish her own identity when she first came to New York. I got her Laura, the role in the television play. I got her a big advance on that book she did with Jackie. I helped her get started in decorating. I did all this for the dear Principessa Radziwill. Stash said to me, goodness, Truman, If you'd do all this for a friend, what would you do for an enemy? Capote smiles. All I can say is I wish he were alive today. I think she very well might be in a highly disturbed state after this show. I think the Princess Lee Radziwill better have an ambulance ready after the show. What Capote had in mind was to tell all about the most intimate aspects of Lee Radziwill's life, both gossip about her life and gossip she had told him, particularly and most deliciously about the Kennedys and her relationship with her sister, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. He had intended to do it in a set piece, a stylized monologue featuring himself as the Southern fag telling all. He had planned it for weeks, going over and over it in his mind, almost memorizing it. He had stayed in the night before, preparing himself as if for a performance, saying, "I want to get myself quiet, calm." It was to be theater. Yesterday morning, when the limousine arrived, Capote descended in his blue linen pants, his plaid jacket, sweater vest, tie, and straw hat, looking better than he has looked in at least 5 years. He has been off drugs and booze for a year now, has taken to swimming a mile every day at the gym, to dieting. He is calmer than before, more mellow. He seemed, for all his anger at Radziwill, rather serene. His sense of humor about the whole event was in high gear. He tested out a few good lines on the way to the studio, giggling with delight, then repeating them over again, savoring the best of them. It was going to be a memorable show. A cassette of the show, he declared with glee, is going to be one of the great comic classics of all time. In fact, the first part of the show was brilliant. It was a superb performance, a takeoff of what he calls the Southern fag. It has a cadence, a rhythm to it, and he was just getting warmed up when Stanley Siegel, his eyes on sticks, got cold feet and began to interrupt. Capote was devastated at first. He told Siegel he'd destroyed the mood. Siegel apologized and tried to let Capote get back into his bit again, but he looked like a football player who had accidentally walked into a gay bar. The show more or less fizzled out. Capote, a perfectionist, knew it. He was depressed. Stanley Siegel was also depressed. "Lee said I was a fag," said Capote. "So I turned myself into the Southern fag. It was a set piece. Stanley didn't understand it. He didn't understand I was supposed to be this half-drunk, crazy queen he'd met in a bar." Never mind. Capote still had all this dirt to get out of his system. It still wasn't too late. He was led out of the bowels of the CBS building and into the bright sun where the limo was waiting to take him back to the UN Plaza. In the limousine, he began to unwind. Soon he was giggling as before. Once inside his apartment, a unique, very personal, exquisitely appointed 4 rooms with a view of the East River, he relaxed totally. Over iced tea, he told all. "Oh, but you don't want to hear any of this, do you? Well, let's just touch lightly on some of the Jackie Lee stuff." "I don't think Jackie has the vaguest idea," he says matter-of-factly, "the extent of Lee's obsession with Jackie." "For one thing," says Capote, "Jackie has no taste. Lee used to say that she, Lee, was the one who was good-looking, who had the taste, who was chic, who could run a home, who was clever, who read books, but it was always Jackie who got all the publicity. And of course, there was some truth to that. I think," he says, "in some strange way, Jackie is as resentful of Lee as Lee is of Jackie. I think Lee as a child got away with murder. Her mother was much tougher on Jackie." "As recently as a few years ago," says Capote, "Jackie's mother slapped her across the face." Now Capote is really getting warmed up. "Once," he continues, "Lee called me in a rage. She said Jackie had just told her that everything Lee had in the world she owed to Jackie. I didn't say it to her at the time, but I think there's a lot of truth to that. Stash Radziwill would have never married Lee if Jack hadn't become president. He even said that to somebody else. Stash was very bitter against Lee." Then, back to the central dirt. about Onassis. Lee really thought she had Onassis nailed down. Lee pretended to have great contempt for Onassis and the marriage. She wasn't in love with him, but she liked all those tankers. I'm not sure that Lee's ever been in love with anybody. Of course, Lee had a crush on Jack. Why wouldn't she? He was just her tasse de thé. Lee, says Capote, was always saying, why do they always write about the Kennedys? They're so dull. As for the Kennedy women, she would say sweetly, they have such lovely skin, skin by T. Anthony. T. Anthony is a semi-chic leather store on Madison Avenue. Lee was involved, Capote says, with some old fellow in England who was going to be prime minister. They were always having lunch. Jackie kept urging her to marry him. Then, when he didn't get to be PM, they dropped him. And, of course, there was the time she supposedly developed a crush on Nureyev. Lee describes his intense animal passion, says Capote. She went to the south of France to decorate his house, he says, and was only slightly taken aback when she found nude pictures of men in the guest room. As for Newton Cope, the man Lee Radziwill recently broke her wedding date with, she was just holding him in reserve. It was, according to Capote, her breakup with society photographer Peter Beard that really shook her to the rafters. That was the beginning of this period of hers of feeling totally undone. Still, says Capote, men to both Lee and Jackie are to be totally controlled, nothing but foot slaves. Lee and Jackie have incredible contempt for everything and everybody. They really do think in the royal we. And neither of them will ever suffer for money, according to Capote. Stash gave Lee a lot of money, and she owned a very valuable piece of land in Greece. I think she got it from Onassis. And she owns a lot of real estate in Long Island, real commercial stuff. She's the most extravagant girl I've ever met. No more than Jackie, though. They have the sense of the right to luxury. Though Truman Capote loves to gossip, though he's having a good time at all of this, though he still maintains his sense of humor, he does say, this is all very funny and amusing, but not if you're in the middle of it. He is not hysterical, but he is a man scorned, a friend who feels betrayed, and his instincts are to strike back. Once he has done so, once he is finished with the bitchy lines and the vituperative lines, once he has, for all good purposes, done in his former best friend, there is finally a sense of sadness about it all, a sense of loss. And Truman Capote is not afraid to admit it, or to admit that he feels he has gotten rid of most of the trash in his life, and I don't mean just people. I've gotten rid of a lot of emotional garbage. Today, he says, he feels at the top of my powers, totally in command of myself and my life. This whole experience with Radziwill has made him think a lot recently about friendship and what it means. Her conniving against me with Gore when I was the single most loyal friend she ever had is very hurtful, to put it mildly, he says quietly. In all truth, I've never known her to be loyal to anyone, or to say a generous thing about anyone that was not qualified. I don't know why I expected to be exempt, but I didn't expect a double cross on this level. I was surprised, but it was due to my own stupidity. I should have known better. Jackie's no different. Capote says that in the beginning of his friendship with Lee Radziwill, he and Jackie were friends too. Jackie and I were friendly, but Lee did a good job turning Jackie against me. She wanted to have me all to herself. Personally, I do think Jackie had something to do with this whole deposition thing. Capote says that when he heard that Radziwill had given a deposition to Vidal's lawyer, saying she had never told Capote the story that Vidal got thrown out of the White House, she just said I was a liar, that's all. I called her to get an explanation. I talked to her secretary. She never called back. Capote says that he was Radziwill's number one confidant until he went through that long period of when I was in and out of the hospital. I wasn't communicating with anybody. But of all of my friends, she never wrote me once to say she hoped I was getting well or wished me luck with my problems. So as far as I know, there has never been any reason for this unbelievable conduct. His explanation for why he allowed himself to be so close to someone he felt was so disloyal is simple. "Love is blind," he says with a shrug. "I've been in love with people before who were just ghastly. I was in love with her like I would have been in love with anybody. I've been in love with a couple of girls along the way, and she was in love with me. For her own purposes, as it turned out." He jumps up from the round portholt-skirted table in the red dining room and goes off for a moment, returning to produce an elegant black gold-lined cigarette box. "A little Johnny Schlumberger number," he says with pride as he opens the box. Inside is this inscription: "To my answered prayer, with love, Lee, July 1967. "Mine," says Capote quietly, "is not the rancor of a rejected lover. You wouldn't just give this box to anybody. I wouldn't exactly say that we had an affair. It was never romantic love, but it was a very emotional friendship. Not a love affair as we know it, an intense emotional relationship." His voice rises now. Why would she make a fool out of herself over this? It's such a trite, trivial, idiotic, small thing, but there are those Capote detractors who believe that his book, Answered Prayers, was in fact a betrayal of all of his friends, that he is getting from Radziwill no better than he deserves. "I didn't betray anybody," insists Capote. "A writer only has material. You have to write about what you know. That's all there is. That's not a betrayal. A betrayal is Lee Radziwill. For her to turn around in my worst moment, when I'm really ill, to give a deposition, it sounds so absurd, so incredible. Lee has always used people. I think when I was so ill, a lot of people thought I was going to die. I wasn't going to pull out. So Lee thought, I don't have to worry about him. I do have to worry about Gore. I don't want to be on his hit list." Capote thinks about this for a moment, then nods his head as though he has decided that this latest speculation is right. Then his small face breaks into a wide grin, and in his high-pitched, delicate voice, beginning to lilt just a touch into a southern accent, he says with glee, "Unfortunately for Princess Radziwill, this fag happens to be alive and well and in New York City." Princess Radziwill had not seen the show yesterday and declined comment. Isn't that the most amazing thing y'all have ever heard? Holy cats, I can't even with that. So much. But here's the thing. Sally Quinn is not done. Continue to take several seats. She has a part two of this article. We're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to get to Hot Blood and Gore, Chapter 2. Oh my, see you in a minute. Investigators, nothing quite gets me excited like primary sources. Sally Quinn, not done. This is a two-part article. This next one is called Hot Blood and Gore, Oh My. Subhead, in which our heroes vilify, sully, and abuse one another's looks, reputations, and work. This particular piece opens with a quote from Gore Vidal: "Litigation takes the place of sex at middle age." So, where did we leave off yesterday? Oh yes, Truman Capote having demolished his former best friend, the divine, the beautiful, the exquisite, the sensitive Principessa Radziwilla, had left us with the fair warning, "This fag happens to be alive and well in New York City." Today, for the stout-hearted, Capote will take on Gore Vidal, and perhaps we will be able to sneak in some of the really serious dirt the lawyers made us take out of yesterday's story in Hot Blood. To recap, Gore Vidal, best-selling author, is suing Truman Capote, best-selling author, for $1 million because Capote told Playgirl magazine that Vidal had once been thrown out of the White House after a dinner party given by the Kennedys for Princess Lee Radziwill and her husband, the late Prince Stanislaus Radziwill. Capote says Lee Radziwill, sister of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, told him the story. He says she was at first willing to testify for Capote, then changed her mind and decided to sign a deposition for Vidal, saying she didn't remember ever telling Capote the story. This treachery moved Capote to go on television Tuesday in New York to denounce Radziwill by turning himself into a southern fag and oozing bitchiness about the hapless princess. Scattered in between his diatribe at Radziwill, who was his major concern Tuesday, were occasional swipes at Vidal, the original protagonist in this whole story, or antagonist, as Capote considers him. Naturally, we had to call Ravello, Italy, where Vidal is ensconced in his seaside villa working on a screenplay, to give him a chance to get his licks in. He was not reluctant to talk. It's only fair to give them equal time. So why did Vidal decide to sue Capote anyway? Vidal: Truman had committed a libel. It was time to take a stand. I did it. It was quite expensive. I'll probably never get anything out of it. He was drunk when he gave the interview to Playgirl. We got a soundtrack of the interview. He was completely sloshed and babbling. Capote: It's his psychosis where I'm concerned. It's not aging very well. And like any almost senile person, they'll go to litigation on almost anything. Vidal: It's his psychosis. He has one about me. I've said it several times that on his shoulders has fallen the feather boa of Hedda Hopper. Vidal is reminded of a story he once told about going to a dinner party, and because he was not wearing his glasses, sitting down on what he thought was a stool, but turned out to be Capote. Actually, I used the word ottoman, corrects Vidal. I mean, y'all, these two, just petty crocker. Okay. Capote: I think Gore went to the White House, got very drunk, and he's not a person who can handle liquor. Became vituperative and was asked to leave and was escorted out. Vidal: Sigh. I drove back with Arthur Schlesinger, George Plimpton, and Ken Galbraith, with whom I had come to the party. But you know that everything Truman says is untrue. It's absolutely eerie. Everything I read that Truman writes on any subject I know about is wrong. And I'm not even speaking now out of malice. Capote: This case is costing me a lot of money, and what nobody realizes is that I'll never get it back. What difference does it matter to Gore? This is a nuisance suit. It's just as cheap as that. Gore wanted to let this case drag on. He thought in the end I'd cave because of the legal fees. Vidal: Sigh. I haven't seen Capote in 7 years, and before that it was 5 years. I haven't seen Lee in 20 years. I think I've met Capote twice in the last 25 years. I don't know Lee at all. When I talk about these people, I'm talking about people I read about in the newspapers. This whole thing is the performing arts. It's just not my game. Capote: Gore is a hack. He hacks out all these things. I'm a writer who works with considerable care. It's not the same thing. Vidal: Answered prayers is just terrible, stale gossip. Capote: Gore tells everybody I have this great sense of rivalry with him. Well, I couldn't care less. His books are totally mediocre. He says I envy his looks and his family background. Well, I certainly don't envy his looks, and he has the thickest, coarsest features. As for his family background, ha! I've seen a relative staggering drunken and toothless through the streets of East Hampton, but it would require days, hours, weeks to tell that story. Vidal: Ha. Truman's the one who first said to me, he imitates Capote's high voice over a bad connection, if I've ever envied you, Gore, over the years, it's for your looks. I did once say Capote has spent most of his life with some success, trying to get into a world I have spent most of my life with some success trying to get out of. Capote: I remember when the Kennedys were in the White House and Gore was living in Connecticut. He would invite people up to his house, and on the table was a photograph of Jackie lovingly inscribed to Gore. It was a forgery. Then he would tell people he was going to Washington for a dinner party, and he'd say, Capote imitates Vidal now, Oh, I really didn't want to go, but Jackie insisted. And then he'd spend the night in a motel and come back the next morning. Vidal: That's pretty funny. Because it's true of Truman. I don't believe Truman ever set foot in the White House when the Kennedys were there. Jackie never liked him. He had one story about how he'd spent the weekend at Buckingham Palace and then flew in for a White House dinner. It's interesting that he would project all of this on me. Capote. I think why this whole lawsuit hit Gore so is that it hit him in his amour propre, which is the Kennedys. And coming from me, it gave him a chance to air his psychotic hatred of me and his relationship with the Kennedys. It, the White House episode, was a terrible blow to him. You see, behind his facade, he's really just a bowl of not-quite-congealed jello, full of terrors and high anxiety. But I'm the one who has real anxieties. Vidal, this is pathology, real nuthouse stuff. So much bad blood between these two. Big problems. I don't think we can solve them. Band-aids don't fix bullet holes. All right. This story really is the gift that keeps on giving. So what happens now? How does it all end up? For as many bangs as we have experienced through this story so far, the end is kind of a whimper. Alan Schwartz recalls, "It was a very strange case. The story that came out in Playgirl was different from what Truman had said over the tape. More sensationalized, though the basic facts in the story were the same as Truman had related them. The appeal we finally made to Gore himself. I got permission from his lawyer. I said, look, this guy's in very bad shape. You may feel that you've been libeled and so forth, but I don't think you want to watch the destruction of a writer of this talent finally, and have anything to do with it. Anyway, Gore finally settled for a half-assed apology and a quarter of his legal fees. A very minor thing." From George Plimpton, the libel suit dragged on for about 7 years. It wasn't until 1983 that the case was finally settled out of court, when Truman wrote a letter of apology. And this is where I'm going to go back to Lawrence Grober and Conversations with Capote. We're going to wrap up the end of that piece, Jackie Gore and Joseph Who. Grober asks, "This has certainly become quite a literary feud that will be talked about in the years to come. Magazines have devoted whole issues to it. So you see yourself as a victim in this affair? It's all been extremely unfair to me. I'm sorry about the whole thing. I'm sorry that Jackie and I came to a falling out to that degree on such a subject, such a level about something I had nothing to do with, basically. Lee is the real villain in this little drama. You've had noted battles with well-known people, and a lot of it has been because you've named names, said what's on your mind. Do you ever regret any of that? I can't remember any of my battles that I regret. In fact, I would relish a few more." Not long after this conversation, Truman agreed to issue the following legal settlement letter, which the newspapers subsequently printed. Here's Truman's apology to Gore. 7 years. The cost? The burning of friendships. So much bad blood. Here's Truman's half-assed apology. "Dear Gore, I apologize for any distress, inconvenience, or expense which I may have caused you. I was not present at the event about which I am quoted in that interview, and I understand from your representatives that what I am reported as saying does not accurately set forth what occurred. I can assure you that the article was not an accurate transcription of what I said, especially with regard to any remarks which might cause aspersions upon your character or behavior, and that I will avoid discussing the subject in the future. Best, Truman Capote." Lawrence Grober follows up saying he asked Truman about this over the phone, but Truman didn't want to talk about it anymore. Truman said it's over with. There's nothing more to say about it. Lawrence Grober adds, "That was one battle I felt that he may or may not have regretted, but that he certainly did not relish." And that, investigators, is the real feud. Wow, wouldn't that have made a better story? the real feud, the one between Truman and Gore and Lee Radziwill. It's Lee, really, and her betrayal of Truman that escalates it to such a degree, but way too complicated and interesting and delicious of a story to keep anything out of it. I just love, love, love these investigations. Friends, thank you so much, as always, for spending your time with me, for telling your friends about Done and Done, for your kind emails and reviews. Y'all are simply the best. All of this arc that we have gone through has numerous, numerous not done yet Easter egg spinoffs. We're going to be rolling those over on patreon.com/doneanddone this week. That $5 level is going to get you all the not done yets. This week, we are packing in so many more stories. Sally Quinn, Grey Gardens, the New Yorker piece where Truman disparaged Gore a little bit more. We're going to talk about Dominic Dunne and a little bit of a line he got on Truman Capote back in 2006 visiting Greenwich. Those are just a few. We got a lot coming up over there. Patreon folks, stay tuned for all the not done yet goodies. Until we meet again on our next Done Day, you know that I want you to stay curious and keep on investigating. Thanks for listening to the Done and Done podcast, a Hemlock Creatives production. You can email us at doneanddone@gmail.com. You can follow us on Instagram at Done and Done Podcast. For further information about our episodes or sources, you can find us online at www.doneanddone.com. See you next week, friends.